Support for programming comes from Cornerstone Bank, family-owned bank providing custom investments, trust, and estate planning services since 1882, with 40 central Nebraska locations. CornerstoneConnect.com. Cornerstone Bank, building trust on a solid foundation. The Nebraska Repertory Theater, presenting the comedy An Act of God, By God, answering all of humanity's deepest questions in 90 minutes, September 26th through October 14th at the Lead Center's Johnny Carson Theater. For show, times, and tickets, leadcenter.org. And History Nebraska, who believe history is more than a list of dates. It's a foundation for a better future told through stories about the past. The future begins at historynebraska.gov.
Welcome to Friday Live here on NET Radio, live from the mill in Lincoln's Haymarket. I'm Genevieve Randall. You won't want to miss a conversation later with bilingual singer-songwriter Gina Chavez, who will perform at Scott's Bluff soon. There are spooky theater productions in both Lincoln and Wayne to learn about this morning, and in about 15 minutes, we'll get a preview of this year's Humanities on the Edge season. If you're going to be away from your radio and you want to listen online, you can stream us online at netnebraska.org/radio. Today is the opening of the eighth season of the First Friday Jazz Series. Ed Love and Friends will be performing at First Lutheran Church here in Lincoln in just a couple of hours, in fact. The concert runs from 11:30 until 1. Ed is here to talk about the concert along with Chris Leach and Lee Rockwell. Thank you all for making time to be here this morning.
You're welcome. Welcome. Our pleasure.
Great to see all of you. So, Lee, this is the eighth season, as I mentioned, of First Friday Jazz, and you organized the series. Tell us a little bit about how the whole series got started, just to review.
I don't know. Somehow it just seemed to me that this would be a great outreach activity for First Lutheran Church. And, we gave it a try, and the first time I thought, if we get 50 people, I'll be happy. 300 people showed up, and it's been that way every first Friday for the last 7 years, and now starting our eighth.
Well, congratulations, Lee. That's great. So, Ed, this is not your first time playing First Friday Jazz. You opened the season last year as well, also with some musical friends. It's a six-person combo today, I understand, including trombonist Chris Leach here. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah. Who are your other cohorts in your ensemble?
Bob Krueger's playing trumpet, and Tom Harville on piano, Hans Sturm on bass, and Justin Jones on drums. It's the same rhythm section I've had there the past couple of years. I think they left their instruments there, after last year, so
just
be ready.
Just kind of left them at the church there. I like that. Chris, how did you get involved in playing with this group?
I'm not sure how I was hoodwinked into this, but I've known Ed Love now for a couple years since moving here to Lincoln from the Chicago area, and he's been very gracious in asking me to play with him. It's always a pleasure.
Yeah, I heard Chris play at the Monday Night Jazz Series, and not only on the trombone, but on piano. He's a brilliant musician in many aspects, a composer, and thought it would be fun to get a young guy on the band,
And it sounds like it'll be kind of a wide-ranging thing, given the name, Jazz History 101. Sounds like maybe even a good introduction for jazz newbies. Where do you start and end with that?
I've retitled it as An Incomplete History of Jazz, because it's only a 90-minute show. And so we're going to play music all the way from New Orleans traditional brass band style songs to something Chris wrote very recently, and through various styles of jazz, Kansas City swing and post-bop and free jazz and fusion and confusion.
Jazz and confusion. Modal jazz.
There you go.
Chris, it's great. We've got some of your original music on the program. You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, I'm very excited for people to hear this piece that I've written. It's called Gracie's Dream. I wrote it while waiting to be inspired, and the inspiration came from my dog, Gracie, who was having some sort of dream. But yeah, it's a great piece, and it's a sort of a modernist take on a samba in the Brazilian style, and I'm sure Ed and everybody else will do it justice.
Well, Chris, next time I see my dog dreaming and see those little foot twitches, I'm going to try and imagine a samba in my head.
Inspiration comes from the craziest places sometimes.
It's true. So, Lee, while we have you here, what are some of the other concerts that listeners can look forward to during the season?
Well, we're doing 8 of them through the first Friday in May. Next month, we've got Peter Bouffard. And in December, Camille Matoya-Moten, who's been a real favorite. All of them are favorites, and we just keep bringing them back because that's what our audience wants.
All right. We've been talking here this morning with Ed Love, Chris Leach, and Lee Rockwell. I know you all need to scoot off and get ready for the show, which starts at 11:30 this morning at First Lutheran Church in Lincoln. Thank you so much for being here this morning, and have fun with the show.
Thank you.
We'll do our best. Thank you.
Find more about this and other events on Friday Live by going to our website. That's at netnebraska.org/radio. A mix of theater, a little bit of history, and definitely some fun come together in a couple of events happening in Wayne. Wayne State College Theater will present a production of Frankenstein. That's October 3rd through the 7th. So tonight and through the weekend in the Black Box Theater there in the Preston Fine Arts Building. And on October 27th, the theater department presents Haunted Trail, beginning and ending at the Mamie McCorkendale School Museum on the campus. And to tell us about both events, I'm joined here on Friday Live by Brian Bagley, Technical Director, and Jeannie Tehan, who's Director of Frankenstein. Welcome to Friday Live.
Hi.
Hi.
So this is an adaptation of Frankenstein. Tell me just a little bit about it.
Well, so this adaptation is written by R.M. Sandberg. A little bit about my own history was I studied Frankenstein adaptations when I was getting my master's in theater. So I read lots and lots of Frankenstein play adaptations, and of course watched a lot of the film versions as well. So when I came here to Wayne State College, I thought, you know, I am dying to do Frankenstein. I know there's a cool production out there that would be great for college students. And I read this adaptation, and I thought, this is a really fun, kind of a psychological look at Victor Frankenstein going through his memories of him creating his monster, and sort of nightmare visions he has of what that meant for him and the people he loved. And so I love this adaptation. The actors we have are doing a great job with it. And I'm just a huge Frankenstein fan, so it's sort of a dream come true for me.
Well, it's interesting you say he focuses on the psychology of it. I wonder if you could give me an example of what you mean by that.
In the history of adaptation, sometimes they just tell the story of kind of following Shelley's novel of here's a scientist. He has this idea of creating immortal life. He does it through this creature, and we kind of follow the journey from there. This one takes place on the ship with the Captain Walton, which is close to Shelley's novel. And from there, we kind of go back through time. We go back through Frankenstein's memories, and it sort of collapses things that supposedly actually happened, like him falling in love with the young woman, Elizabeth, and him talking to his father about going to college and him having the idea to create this creature. And also sort of these visions collapsed of like his mother coming back to life or what it would mean if he creates this monster and there are more creations that happen after that. So it's kind of a mix of surreal nightmare and memory, and it's really centered around Victor Frankenstein, our young actor who plays that part. It's a lot of work for him, and he's doing a marvelous job. Mm-hmm.
How many aspects of production are students involved in then, like costuming, crew, lighting, set design?
Our students do everything. They're involved with everything. They're involved with lighting and designing makeup, and we have a student costumer who costumed all of the characters, and they work with us as well, but our students are the centerpiece of the production.
So what does this show look like? Can you paint a scene for me?
It's a very plain, simple, white space. It takes place on a ship that's in the Arctic, freezing to death, but it's not realism, so things are just kind of vaguely suggested We have to have an escape coffin that people get in and then escape out of, so we had to build some platforming to deal with that kind of an issue. It's a very sparse, simple set in a very small performance space. We have 92 seats down there, so it's a small black box theater.
Moving on to the October 27th Haunted Trail event, Halloween just seems like a time when everyone actually embraces a little bit of theater. What might some attendees see along the trail?
It's October 26th, 27th, and the 31st. So we're running three nights. The trail is a long walking trail, and you walk in the dark, although obviously we have flashlights, and there are stairs all along this outdoor trail. It goes through some trees and through a little field, and it's a delightful little nature walk during the day, but at night, for three nights out of the October, it turns into a place of scares and wild stuff.
And
kind of your typical spook house fair, just outdoors.
And the trail begins and ends near the Mamie McCorkindale School Museum. I have to admit, I don't know that we've talked about that museum on the show. Can you tell us what that is?
I know very little about it, except that it's an old schoolhouse. And it's just a very small little schoolhouse that was in Wayne County in the late 1900s.
I've been talking here with Brian Begley as well as Jeannie Tehan about two Wayne State College Theater presentations. This weekend through October 7th, they present an adaptation of Frankenstein in the Black Box Theater. And then October 26th, 27th, and 31st, they present The Haunted Trail. Brian and Jeannie, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to Friday Live here on NET Radio and netnebraska.org.
Romance novels have changed quite a bit from those bodice-ripping yarns with a shirtless Fabio on the cover. All About Books special guest Kirsten Hill gave up feeling guilty about her enjoyment of these books.
I used to kind of whisper to people, you know, I read romance. And it came to me that I didn't want to really be embarrassed about it anymore. I want to really own this genre that I love, and I'm really proud to be what I consider a small part of it as a blogger and, again, as a reader and as a romance lover and a promoter of the genre. I wanted to be really proud of that.
You'll learn a lot about the post-Fabio world of modern romance novels and this financially successful area of the book world where the authors and audience are mostly women. Check out this week's All About Books on our website, netnebraska.org/allaboutbooks. The seventh season for the Humanities on the Edge speaker series begins next Thursday with a talk by Kent A. Ono. Here to tell us about that talk and another one later this month with Lee McIntyre is Humanities on the Edge lead organizer Angel Maldonado, who's also assistant professor in the communications department, and co-founder Marco Abel, who is also professor of communications and both at University of Nebraska-Lincoln. Good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
So, Angel, this year's talks are called Post-Truth Futures. What exactly does that mean?
Post-truth refers to the sort of political climate that we are experiencing today. We often refer to this as the way in which media has been referred to as fake news, for example, or how discourses about science are being challenged in a larger discourse. We can think about things like evolution or vaccinating our children or whether climate change has actually affected contemporary.
Yeah, a lot of those current issues that we hear about.
Weather patterns, sorry, contemporary weather patterns.
Yeah. Now, Marco, if you would tell us about this first lecture, Kent A. Ono's talk called The Rhetoric of Sanctuary in the Post-Truth Era.
Yes, he will actually be our 35th speaker. We are in our ninth year now, and he will inaugurate this year with a talk that primarily deals with undocumented immigrants and the notion of sanctuary, you know, like how the very idea of sanctuary is discussed, what kind of claims are being made about this, whether it's useful for undocumented immigrants to have a notion of sanctuary, and how the very context in which the notion of truth has been put in suspense, so to speak, affects any notion of the sanctuary in its own right, right? Like, because if you think about the notion of truth in a traditional sense, it's a very stable idea. There is the truth. Mm-hmm. What happens if we no longer believe in such a thing? And from multiple perspectives, this could be from the political right, from the political left, from all kinds of perspectives. Sanctuary is also something that is meant to be stable, right? Yeah. Like a haven of some kind. So what is the connection between that when we undo a notion such as truth and a notion of giving people a safe haven, a sanctuary?
You know, I have to say, I'm curious a little bit about your own personal opinion about that particular issue. You're originally from another country.
Yes.
So I wonder if,
yes.
Both of you, right?
Yes.
I wonder if you would mind sharing any thoughts about that.
Well, one of the interesting things is that this phenomenon is not sort of new to other political contexts. We see this happening in places like the Philippines, for example, in China. In my own native country, Mexico, post-truth definitely affected the last elections. And one of the things that I've noticed is a sort of shift in what makes people comfortable and how can they sort of fall back on something that is less dangerous, maybe less threatening.
Yes, in Germany, of course, we have also debates about this. As your listeners might know, Germany has let in about 1 million refugees fairly recently because of Chancellor Merkel's decision to do so, which I think was a tremendous decision. I'm very much in favor of it. But that too unhinges things in the social order, as it were, and you get similar kind of forces that the United States also has. Where people are afraid. People are afraid of the other, that which they don't know. And then they have recourse to arguments that are often not based on any kind of rigorous notion of the truth anymore, but on fabricated notions of what is and is truth. So to just give one example, for instance, a lot of anti-immigrant rhetoric in Germany takes place in the former East, and yet it is precisely in the former East where there are hardly any immigrants, any refugees. Most of the refugees are in entirely other places, and yet those people are quite scared of the presence of those refugees in Germany, even though they are not in their home communities.
Well, and that's interesting to hear since it's been since 1994, 93, you know, and there's a big difference still between East and West.
Yes.
Is what I'm hearing.
Yes.
Well, we should also talk about the next speaker as well. I believe that, let's see. Oh, Lee McIntyre's talk about post-truth in the internet age. You want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yes. Lee McIntyre is a research fellow at Boston University, and the way that we're thinking about him is he really wrote the quintessential book titled Post-Truth out of MIT Press, and perhaps Marco can take the lead here.
Yeah, so Lee McIntyre is a philosopher, and one thing that is perhaps worthwhile remembering is that the undermining of truth is often associated with the notion of so-called postmodernism, right? Like in the 90s, there was a lot of talk about this in the New York Times and in popular media, that the so-called notion of postmodernism was about relativism, about nihilism, of not believing in anything anymore, that everything is relative, that we don't have any stable criteria that we can refer to. And of course, there is some truth to this, because there was a critique of a very traditional, patriarchal, normative, hegemonic understanding of truth that has hurt people of color, women, queer people, and so forth. So there was indeed a questioning of truth, However, the far end on the other side of the spectrum turned this criticism of truth into fake news, so to speak. And Lee McIntyre is an analytic philosopher who probably will offer a critique of this postmodern criticism of truth, and he will probably parse out what useful ways how we can usefully think about truth in the present, especially in a present that is dominated by digital media, by the internet, where everything goes so fast and it comes and it goes and it disappears and people take down statements and yet people are recording statements, you know. And then how can we have a debate where we can still sit at the same table and agree that we are sitting at a table? Right? I think that's sort of like the big question that we have relinquished an agreement on a very fundamental level.
And just to review a little bit about the Humanities on the Edge series in general, Marco, you co-founded the series in 2010 with Roland Bankshaw. And Angel, you're the new lead organizer this year for the series, and that's been sort of over the last few years. There have been different faculty and different people involved. I wonder if you could just kind of talk about the origins and how the series has grown over the years, and Angel, how you became the new lead organizer this year.
One of the things that I noticed when I joined the the University of Nebraska-Lincoln is that there is a robust interest in humanities research, and this is sort of evidenced by this interdisciplinary lecture series. And really, Roland and Marco have been very, very sort of supportive of my own research, and this is sort of evidenced by the types of speakers that are going to be joining us. Kent Ono in particular comes from a rhetorical background in communication studies. He finished his doctoral degree in the University of Iowa, just sort of down the road, and he's actually part of what they refer to as the Iowa School, sort of a moment where rhetorical studies sort of started looking at postmodern versions of truth. Our other speaker, who is coming in on March 7th of next year, has sort of written a book that I found very important in my own career. So I'm really happy to see her. Her name is Wendy Chun, and she's at Brown University.
Okay, great.
And then the fourth speaker will be Charlotte Biltikoff, who is an associate professor of American Studies and Food Sciences, and she will collaborate with the Sheldon Museum. The Humanities on the Edge has, for the last 9 years, collaborated with the Sheldon. We have all of our talks at the Sheldon Auditorium, and they're quite generous in their support of us, and we are quite grateful for this. And so she will talk about real food, real facts, truth, politics, and power in the U.S. food and information landscape, and we'll wrap up our ninth year. The basic premise of our collaboration is we are also working with Jeanette Jones, who is in the Department of History and the Institute for Ethnic Studies, as well as Carrie Morgan of the Sheldon, is that we let individual people pursue their own interests in the context of Humanities on the Edge, in their own intellectual research interests. And so, because Angel is new to the university and we felt there's a good synergy between his interests and what the speaker series has been trying to accomplish, we invited him not only to join us, but also to take the intellectual lead based on his own research interests, just as in previous years we had topics on, say, race and ethnicities, which Jeanette Jones, for instance, spearheaded, or last year we were inspired by the 50th anniversary of the events of May 68, as well as the 100th anniversary of the Russian Revolution. And then next year we'll go into our 10th year, and we haven't decided yet what we will do, but I think Roland and I will perhaps for the last time sort of, you know, like do a year. 10 years is a long time, so.
Yes. And it's always, I'm sure, a lot of work for all of you. It's always wide-ranging, of course, as an interdisciplinary series, very well thought out, involving politics, philosophy, history, current events, and everything. The Humanities on the Edge speaker series, beginning its 8th season, is that correct?
Ninth season.
We're
old.
I was two off before. Yeah, right, because you just mentioned 10 years coming up. Amazing. So that starts next Thursday at 5:30 p.m. And again, that's at the Sheldon Museum of Art on the UNL campus. That beginning speaker is a talk by Kent A. Ono. Angel Maldonado and Marco Abel, both from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln, thanks so much for telling us about the season.
Thank you.
For having us.
Informing and inspiring Nebraska with unique programming, this is NET Radio. On Friday Live, I have a conversation with an Austin-based musician who will be bringing some outreach and workshops to schools and a detention center in Scotts Bluff. That's coming up in about 8 minutes. Next, I'm joined at my table here at the Mill by cast from the Tada Theater production of Evil Dead the Musical, which runs October 11th through the 28th. Michael Tully and Chloe Schwarting, welcome to Friday Live.
Thank you for having us.
And I hear that this was a show that sold out and had a giant waiting list last year, so that's why you guys are reprising this, is that correct?
Yes, indeed. It was a big success. You know, with Evil Dead kind of in the public spotlight again after many years, you know, Bruce Campbell starred in these films in 1981. 1987 was Evil Dead 2, and Army of Darkness was 1992. They were cult classics, and he reprised the role in the last three seasons on the Starz network in a series called Ash vs. Evil Dead. So there's this whole, you know, kind of counterculture, subculture of fans who really love the movies, and we've got a lot of people who normally wouldn't be coming to music theater, to be honest with you, who are showing up to see zombies, you know, be shot by shotguns and for me to wield a chainsaw and all that great stuff.
And honestly, I feel like the musical aspect just sort of turns up the volume on that whole cult classic, the feel of the Evil Dead stuff and all Bruce Campbell's work. Do you agree with me on that?
Yeah, totally.
Yeah.
Totally. And so, you know, the music, it's much like a rock opera, you know, and in that we are mounting the musical here in October. You know, Tada has done great shows in October, that Halloween month, if you will, Adam's Family, Young Frankenstein. Kind of like the Rocky Horror Picture Show vibe as well. So we'd like to describe the musical as Scooby-Doo meets Deadpool.
And with that in mind and the shooting of zombies and all that, probably we should just mention right away, what kind of audience is this for?
Honestly, everyone. I always say this is a musical for people who would never think that they would want to go to a musical. It's hilarious, it's super upbeat, and it's just completely over the top. Absolutely
but
wonderful.
But maybe not for kids.
Oh, definitely PG-13.
Okay, gotcha.
Absolutely.
Chloe, what character do you play and what is she like?
So I play Linda. She's Ash's girlfriend. She's very girl next door, very sweet, very loving, until she gets possessed by a demon. and then she
That's always a bad turn in a relationship, you know?
Slightly less lovely, kind of complicates the relationship a bit. He might chop off my head. No big deal.
You know,
normal relationship.
That story, boy meets girl, boy chops off girl's head.
Right, right.
Girl's headless body chases boyfriend around.
Right, right. And not for the faint of heart, this show, I have to say. And Michael, you play Ash, who, I love this description, is described as a housewares employee turned demon-killing hero.
Yes.
So my question is, what kind of housewares?
Well, he works in aisle 3. Uh-huh. We know that.
Okay.
Selling blenders and colanders and all the sorts of things. Where do you work?
I think I'm a cashier.
Oh, she's
so
a cashier.
So our characters actually met at work, and we sing a whole beautiful duet about it.
Right. A lot of great backstory here. But, you know, the show as a whole, I mean, it's your typical story. You know, a boy and his friend go on a week-long vacation in the woods. 3 friends turn into Candarian demons. 1 friend is then killed by a forest of evil trees, while 2 demons then kill their boyfriends, respectively, while 1 demon stays in the cellar trying to kill everything in sight.
And what I love about this is I think it appeals to both those fans of sort of that horror genre, but also fans of comedy because it's intensely funny.
Definitely. Definitely.
I heard a song with the lyrics, "We're 5 college students on our way to an old abandoned cabin in the woods."
Yes.
Which, you know, sounds scary with just the lyrics, but really is rather an upbeat little number. Can you talk about how the music carries this show along?
Yeah, absolutely. So it starts off and it's so like upbeat and happy. And I think my favorite like part of that song is there's a moment where one character goes, "What could possibly go wrong with 5 college students going to an abandoned cabin where no one knows where we are?" And we all just kind of like, and then just jump right back into it. And the whole thing is like that. Like, it's very tongue in cheek. Some of the songs, I can't say the names of them because it's not appropriate for radio, but it's all very funny. Like, one is called "All the Men in My Life Keep Getting Killed by Candarian Demons." Just very tongue-in-cheek.
Over the top. You know, there's bits of campiness, bits of horror. And I should say, you know, we should speak to the special effects that kind of work in conjunction with the music to really drive home the theme. Great lighting, great props and stage direction happening here. And then, you know, what ties it together really in a great way is the fact that we have a splatter zone. The first 2 rows in the theater are dubbed the splatter zone, and so people are encouraged to BYOP, bring your own poncho, or we have them for sale at the theater as well.
Perfect. You know it's going to be exciting when you need a poncho
in the
first 2 rows of the show. Well, anything that we're missing before we run out of time? Because that's a lot.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I guess I would just speak to the way in which, works as far as Bob and Chris Rook, directors there. They've got these shows happening, you know, every 8 weeks, basically. And to be so passionate about theater in a town like this, they are a mainstay, a staple here in the Haymarket area. And they're just known for bringing in great talent. And I know even last year, as Chloe and I would greet people with the rest of our cast afterwards, people would make comments. Such as, "Oh, so now where are you headed next?" I say, "Well, I'm actually headed home."
Yeah.
You know, but
right here.
Yeah, and being in the university town and having this tie-in, it's just wonderful to bring in musicians of this caliber. So I'm humbled and honored to be a part of it and work with such great musicians and actors.
Michael Tully and Chloe Schwarting, both part of the Ta-Da Theater production of Evil Dead the Musical, and that show runs October 11th through the 28th, and you can link to more information right there on the Friday Live page of our website at netnebraska.org. Michael and Chloe, my goodness, have fun with this cult classic.
Will do.
Thank you very much.
If your boss just caught you listening to that interview online and you wish you could catch up with Friday Live a little bit later, you can. We podcast the show each and every week, and you can look for that this afternoon on our Facebook page or on our website. The address is netnebraska.org.
Genevieve Randall. You're listening to Friday Live here on NET Radio.
Events. Here's some highlights. Julie Snyder, Beautiful Nebraska Artist Show and Reception is tonight starting at 6 p.m. at the Schoolhouse Art Gallery in Brownville. The show runs through October 26th. For the first time in Nebraska, Jay and the Americans perform hits of the 60s and 70s. That's at the Merriman Performing Arts Center in Kearney, and that show is Tuesday at 7 p.m. And Chadron State College Theater presents The Odd Couple this weekend at Memorial Hall Auditorium with shows tonight and tomorrow at 7:30 and Sunday at 2 p.m. For more information about these and other events, visit our website, netnebraska.org/radio.
Support for humanities-related programming on NET Radio comes from Humanities Nebraska. The 23rd Annual Governor's Lecture is October 9th. Presidential historian John Meacham will explore the watershed year of 1968 and its long-term effects. For details, humanitiesnebraska.org.
You're listening to Friday Live, NET Radio's weekly showcase of arts and humanities in Nebraska.
Gina Chavez, the multi-ethnic Latin pop and 10-time Austin Music Award winner, is coming to Scotts Bluff for a performance at the Historic Midwest Theater on Thursday, October 11th at 7:30 p.m. She will also give outreach workshops at local schools and the Scotts Bluff County Detention Center while she's in town. She's been featured by NPR's All Things Considered, as well as NPR's Tiny Desk Concerts, and her 2014 album, Uprooted, was voted Austin Album of the Year. And she joins me right now here on Friday Live. Gina Chavez, it's such a pleasure to meet you.
So great to meet you. Thanks for having me on.
Your songs are bilingual. Can you talk about why that's important to you?
I'm half Mexican and half Swiss German and fully Texan. And I didn't really grow up with my Latin roots. And so I was doing a study abroad semester, seems like eons ago, but I did a study abroad semester in Buenos Aires, Argentina, when I was a junior in college at the University of Texas. And I don't know, there's something about the type of folk music that I heard there that really called to me. In Spanish, you would say, me llamó la atención. And it's like it like called my attention. And so I started attempting to kind of write songs in Spanish, even though it's not my native tongue. I didn't grow up speaking it at home. I didn't really grow up with much access to my Latin roots. And so music became a doorway to discover that. And because I didn't really grow up within the trappings of any particular culture, such as the Mexican culture, I kind of found that in travel, I got to be a sponge and just kind of pick up what called to me, what my heart wanted to pick up. And so I would say my music definitely takes influences from all over Latin America, really from all over the Americas. So I think it just was a natural fit for me to try and infuse some of this stuff into my music. And I found that audiences really love it, too.
Ahead of your concert at the Midwest Theater, you'll be appearing at some local schools, and you'll give a matinee performance for 4th through 6th graders. Do you regularly do that kind of outreach?
My band and I have had the chance to travel with the U.S. State Department as cultural ambassadors, and so a lot of times we'll do very similar activities when we're abroad in countries like Saudi Arabia or Uzbekistan or Venezuela, and we'll do kind of daytime workshops with any number of groups. Maybe it's a school for children with disabilities. So we'll have a chance to kind of like really be on the ground and meeting people in the area. And then that night we do free public concerts when we're doing the State Department tours. And so this is very similar, and we love this kind of work. I love meeting young people and kind of seeing what's going on, especially in other parts of our country.
I'm curious about your appearance at the Scotts Bluff County Detention Center as well. How did that come about, and what will you do there?
I think for me, a lot of my music is kind of confronting my own privilege. I've had a lot of opportunities. I've had a lot of love in my life. I've had a lot of support, and a lot of people don't have that. That's not necessarily a common experience. I welcome opportunities to meet people that are in different circumstances. I'm really excited about the opportunity to visit the detention center and, you know, to share some music, but also hopefully share some stories and get to hear what they're going through.
So speaking of your music, we have a brand new track that you're releasing today titled It's Hard to Love a Woman, and we'll be hearing a little bit of that in just a minute or two here at the end of your interview. Can you tell us about this song?
It really came from me taking some time off of touring and traveling the world and just taking some time to dive into the art of songwriting. And so the long story short is that what came out was a little bit of the love story of my wife and I. And so we met at the University Catholic Center 12 years ago at the University of Texas. And last year we got married.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thanks. Oh, thanks so much. I think for us, being able to get married in Texas, and we are still practicing Catholics, you know, and having those two realities be something that we can hold in our hearts is just really exciting. And so in a lot of ways, this EP is that story, is the story of us going from having to hide our relationship to being in a place where we can shout it from the rooftops. It's a message that I hope to spread to people in a lot of circumstances who might feel like they have to hide. It's an interesting time in our country right now, but I do feel like it's also an exciting time where we're starting to hear more diverse voices and people are starting to understand the power of their own voice. And so that's what this album's about.
It's an interesting title because if I just look at the title alone, it feels like one of those, you know, universalities that anybody could recognize. It's hard to love a woman, you know, but I'm hearing so much of you, and it's so much personal that you have poured into this song.
It's not my favorite title for that reason, but I also kind of like that it's a little bit intriguing. It's actually the first line of the song, and the rest of it says, it's hard to love a woman just as she deserves. It's a love song about being with somebody and knowing you're going to let them down. And at the same time, realizing that their smile is the thing that makes your heart beat.
Now we have just a little bit of time left, Dina, but I'd really love to hear if you could just a little bit about your travels to El Salvador.
Jody, my wife and I, before we were married, we spent 8 months doing mission work in El Salvador through a Catholic organization. And we taught English to girls in an all-girls school that was run by Catholic nuns. It was completely life-changing. Jody and I actually started a college scholarship fund for young women, and we've been doing benefit concerts to raise money for the past 8 years since we've been back from El Salvador. And this year we actually celebrated all four of our students' graduations. And the college fund is called Niñas Arriba. And so El Salvador is still very much a part of our lives. And we go back every other year or so to reconnect and also to grow the program.
A powerful voice in more than one way, Gina Chavez appears in Scotts Bluff in concert at the Midwest Theater on Thursday, October 11th at 7:30 p.m. She will also be presenting music and outreach workshops in local schools and at the Scotts Bluff County Detention Center. Gina Chavez, thank you for your time.
Thanks so much. Looking forward to it.
Challenging, informing, and inspiring, this is NET Radio and NETNebraska.org.
It's hard to love a woman just as she deserves. Her heart is like an ocean and I'm lost in the surf. A thousand waves could carry me to the land of sweet perfume. Waves might dance beneath a moonbeam, but the tide waits on her cue. My heart.
That's Gina Chavez performing her newest release, It's Hard to Love a Woman. And you can link to more about her Scottsbluff appearance on our website at netnebraska.org/radio. Representation of martial arts in film as part of Asian culture and as part of history has changed over the years, and a month-long celebration of martial arts will explore that.
Gary taught me the meaning of kung fu in Chinese. It literally just means hard work. And so kung fu is a generic catch-all term culturally, historically, that it's not some very unique thing that's only practiced by a small group of people, but it's actually a philosophy that can be internalized by everyone.
Rose Hewson and Gary Yoon are my guests for the first half of this week's Friday Live Extra podcast. You can hear them talk about martial arts in film, with music, and at family events. And you can hear about today's St. Paul Music and Arts Series concert and a preview of the season, all on this week's Friday Live Extra. Download wherever you get your podcasts or listen online at netnebraska.org/radio. Stay with Friday Live to learn about a harpist coming to Lincoln for a concert, a theater work based on a Nebraska story, and meet two authors being honored today at an event this afternoon and this evening. All of that ahead in the next 15 minutes here on Friday Live. My next guest is a native of Baltimore, Maryland, but has lived most of her life in Nebraska, including work on her PhD in English at UNL, also teaching at UNL. She was assistant editor in poetry for Prairie Schooner magazine and assistant editor for Ted Kooser's American Life in Poetry. Her newest book is Union Square, which launches tomorrow at the Bookworm in Omaha at 1 p.m. And then she appears in Lincoln at Francie and Finch Bookshop on Thursday from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m. for a reading and a book signing. Author Adrian Kesters, welcome to Friday Live.
Thank you. It's really a pleasure to be here.
The book is a novel which takes place in the Union Square neighborhood of Baltimore. The cover even depicts those row houses that one might see in Baltimore. And the time period is 1952. So why that time?
Well, the time period predates me by not a lot, but a little bit. And 1952 is actually considered the beginning of what was called the Great Decline in Baltimore. And so for people who have been fans of, say, The Wire, they can understand what happened to Northwest Baltimore. So the neighborhood I come from is Southwest Baltimore, and the racial lines and all of that are very, very well-defined. But we live three blocks down from where H.L. Mencken, the famous journalist, lived his entire life. Mencken died, I believe, in 1953 or 54, I'm not real sure. But I somehow wanted to have him there. But I also, this is the first of three novels, and so the impulse was to go back to where that neighborhood was still considered kind of a classy place, kind of a well-to-do, or at least had a history of well-to-do people living there. By the time I came along, that was no longer true. So the next two novels are going to be about the no longer that being true. But what I wanted to do was to look at how does a place like that become the place that I knew.
Yeah, interesting, because Baltimore really does, there's been so much change in that city since that time. There is a young Irish boxer named Paddy Dolan in the book. Who's he and what does he represent?
Yeah, a friend of mine is writing a novel, and I told him about my novel, and he said, so does it have a car crash? And I said, no, but it has an Irish boxer. So one of the themes is the Irish diaspora. Her mother's side of the family all came over pretty early in the first wave, I think, to New York State. My grandmother and great-grandmother were in service. And what I wanted to, what he represents is displacement, first of all. He's also someone who becomes a very violent person, and so the other, you know, big theme of the book is interpersonal violence, sadly very topical right now. What I wanted to do with that character was to get as close inside his head as I could to say, how does this person happen? where does this kind of person come from, and why does this kind of person go on in the way that he does.
Do you go back to Baltimore to visit often?
Well, I was there in 2017. Clorinda Harris of Brick House Books has published both of my books of poetry, and I was very fortunate to do a poetry reading of my second book, 3 Days with a Long Moon, at the Ivy Bookshop, which is like Francie and Finch, I would guess. So we just had a really, really nice time. I had a really tough time being there, though. I hadn't been for a long time. My grandmother passed away in the late 90s, and I hadn't been since. It was not easy to go back. Mm. It wasn't easy to go back.
Probably for personal reasons. Personally, but also, yeah.
I mean, in one way, it was fantastic to be there, but yet the kind of memories and all of that became a little tough to take. Yeah.
Well, and it'll be interesting to hear from you again as you write the other two books, I'm hearing, is what you're planning?
Right. So the second one is takes place in 1964, and then the final one is 1968. All of them take place over April 4th and 5th, because for me anyway, I mean, I left in 1972, well, 73. Left the city and did not live there again. 1968 for me was, and everybody really, was when that city changed. Obviously the April 5th riots after the assassination of Dr. King. So my real purpose of writing all three books was to get to that book, and I am going to need to do quite a lot of research for the final one, for sure. So I'm hopeful that I'll have some time in Baltimore and time at the Pratt Library and maybe at Hopkins and who knows, but I really feel like I need to get the that time and place and the facts of the city and all of that, really know them inside and out. One thing I would like to, this all sounds sort of dire, you know, but I think the novel's also really funny, and the characters I think are very accessible, and I mean, it's, to me, some of them are a riot. So I don't know if that's Irish dark humor or what, but
well, I was going to say, often I think there are many people who deal with darkness or with pain with humor. You know what I mean?
That's
a way of coping.
Yeah, well, I mean, I believe that's the Irish national way of coping with pain. So it's both. I mean, I certainly take all of those things seriously, and I'm writing about them for serious reasons, but the language and the interactions between people are often, in my opinion, very funny.
Adrienne Kesters is the author of a brand new novel, Union Square. She launches the book in Omaha tomorrow and then appears at Francie and Finch in Lincoln on Thursday for a reading and a signing from 6 to 7 p.m. Thanks so much for telling us about your new book. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for having me. It's great to meet you.
You're listening to Friday Live, broadcasting this week from the Mill Coffee and Tea in Lincoln's historic Haymarket District. Find out more about this and everything you hear about here on Friday Live by going to our website at netnebraska.org/radio. Thank you. I'm Genevieve Randall. This is Friday Live on NET Radio. The Nebraska Library Association has a Nebraska Children's Choice Book Award, the Golden Sower Award, and I'm so thrilled to have this year's winners with me here this morning. Lewis Sacker is the author of Holes, Sideways Stories from Wayside School, and Fuzzy Mud, which is the book receiving the 2018 Chapter Book Award this year. Also, K.A. Holt is the author of Gnomageddon, Red Moon Rising, and House Arrest. And House Arrest was selected as the 2018 novel winner. They're both being honored at the Golden Sower Gala this evening at the Cornhusker Marriott at 6:30 p.m. And we'll talk a little bit about a book signing this afternoon as well. Congratulations to you both.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. Let's see, that's at Francie and Finch for that book signing, not too much later than right now. How did each of you find out, first of all, that you were being selected for this Golden Sower Award? Carrie Ann, do we want to start with you?
Sure, yeah. I got an email from the woman who runs the committee, and it was very exciting. Because I had gotten an email previously that said, you know, your book is on the list and the kids are going to read all these different books and they will vote for a winner. So to hear that I actually won was very exciting. I was like, you know, yelling at my kids, I won a major award. It's a major
so
award.
Cool. And Lewis, for you, how did you find out?
I think she posted something on my website saying that I'd won. It's hard to remember, but this is actually the second time I won. The first one was like 20 years ago, so it's pretty amazing.
Well, congratulations again. And Lewis, tell us about Fuzzy Mud.
It's the main character is a sort of this 10-year-old girl who, unlike a lot of heroines in books, is sort of this quiet, goody-goody girl who just wants to please her teachers and, you know, a lot like my daughter was when she was growing up. And, but then when courage is really needed, you know, she has it. And it's sort of this environmental disaster book that she helps save the day in a way.
Do you often pull from people that you know or people in your own life for some of your book characters?
Sometimes I pull from everywhere, you know, and it's often maybe something that someone said 15 years ago that I'll suddenly remember and it'll turn into a character in a book. But this case, it was my daughter.
Now, Carrie Ann, your book is called House Arrest, as I mentioned. What is that story about?
So House Arrest is about a boy named Timothy who, at the beginning of the book, has been arrested for stealing a credit card. Rather than going to juvie, he is sentenced to a year of house arrest. And part of his sentence is that he has to keep a journal for that year, and his probation officer and his court-appointed therapist have to read the journal and communicate with him. And so the reason why Timothy stole the credit card is because his little brother Levi is very, very sick, and they were not able to afford some medicine that he needed. And so Timothy is making impulsive poor choices, but he's doing them for good reasons.
So what inspired you to tell that tale? There's a lot of serious issues that your characters are dealing with.
It is serious, but I will say it's funny too. Like, Timothy is a funny kid, and so my youngest son had a tracheostomy, which is what the baby Levi has in house arrest, and it was a difficult time for me and my family, and I often thought about how hard it was to afford the medicine and stuff. And so it was a great cathartic thing for me to write about a kid who could do all the things that I couldn't do because I was a responsible adult.
Well, this makes me think of something I read on your website, which is you say that all of your books are for kids, but grown-ups are allowed to read them too.
Yes.
So it sounds like maybe someone, no matter what age, could get something out of sharing this experience with the characters in the book and with you, it turns out.
I would hope so. And I try really hard in my writing to make sure that the adults in the books are also well-rounded, three-dimensional characters, like they all have their own arcs. Because I want, no matter what age you are, I want you to get something out of the book, you know.
Now, Lewis, many of our listeners probably know that you wrote both the book Holes, but then also the screenplay
too, right?
For that as well. You started your career with kind of this part-time law, part-time author sort of career going on. What sparked your writing career, do you think?
Well, I'd always been interested in writing. Law was just something, I worked at a sweater warehouse and was writing at night, writing what became Sideways Stories from West Side School. Got fired from the job and thought, well, what'll I do? I'll go to law school.
And not to interrupt you, but I love the specificity of sweater warehouse. Yeah, well, I don't know why, but that's an interesting detail.
Yeah, it's funny. That's just what it was. It was this giant warehouse, and we, packed sweaters to send to different stores.
Yeah.
So then I went to law school, but I finished writing Sideways Stories and was sending that out to publishers. Same time I was sending out law school applications, got accepted to law school in San Francisco. And then my first week there, I heard from a publisher who wanted to publish the book. So it was this real two different things pulling at me for a long time.
Well, it's good to have a backup plan,
I guess.
For any plan, yeah. Right? Both of you will be signing books this afternoon at Francie and Finch, and then also after tonight's ceremony. What's it like for both of you meeting those readers, both young and old? I'm sure you have some stories.
To me, that's the thing that makes writing books worth it, right? It reminds you why you're writing these books. And I will get emails from kids who will say, your book is the first book that I've ever read from beginning to end. Or they'll say, when I was a baby, I had a trach, and now I'm in high school, and I just wanted you to know I'm okay and that Levi would be okay. And Levi's not real, even though he's based on my son, he's not real. And so I love this connection, and that they feel like, they've been seen, right? And that they connect with you in some way. And it really, it's a gift, really.
Yeah, it's, writing is a very, lonely, personal thing to do. And I completely block out the fact that there are, books have been read by literally millions of people. And because you can't let that enter your head when you're working. And so then when I go out on the road and suddenly, instead of this solitary person, suddenly all these people want my autograph and are happy to meet me, it's like I'm two different people.
Interesting.
Yeah, it feels kind of ridiculous. I just was visiting some kids at a middle school, and they thought I was going to show up in a limo, right? And that was the most hilarious thing to me. I was like, oh my gosh, no.
But that shows you how they think about you, right?
Right.
It's amazing.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and it's nice you've both decided to connect with kids, too. I think that that's such an important age for kids to connect with reading, to be imagining new things, lots of things going on there, I think.
Yeah, it's also fun to write about kids because the world is still so open to them.
Yeah, for real. And it's kind of a challenge, too, right? Because, there are things that you want to talk about and impart, and you can't talk about it like the way that you would with an adult, right? You have to be more creative, and, I just love the imagery that you have to come up with to be a 12-year-old boy in your book.
Yeah. I've been talking here this morning with authors Lewis Sackar and with Carrie Ann Holt. Congratulations again on winning the Golden Sower Award to both of you.
Well,
thank you very much.
You're welcome. The Golden Sower Award is presented by the Nebraska Library Association at a ceremony and dinner this evening at 6:30 p.m. That's at the Cornhusker Marriott. Before that, both of these authors appear from noon to 1 p.m. at Francie and Finch Bookshop in Lincoln. And for more information, you can go to the Friday Live page at netnebraska.org/radio.
historic blizzard in Nebraska is retold on stage. We'll hear more in about 8 minutes here on Friday Live. Next, I'm joined by Brian Foltner from the Arts for the Soul series at First Presbyterian in Lincoln. They host harpist Bridget Kibbe for a concert at 3 p.m. on Sunday. Good morning, Brian.
Thanks for having me.
I watched a video of Bridget playing the Bach Toccata in D minor, by the way, but on a harp instead of an organ, and it was really pretty amazing. How did you discover her?
Well, I get a lot of things sent to me from different people, and some catch my eye, and that was one that really caught my eye. And I like to find things that are a little different and maybe that people haven't heard before, and people that are just incredible musicians out there, and she fit the bill for all those. You don't see a lot of harp recitals, and she's a very compelling performer. Bach piece is amazing. I mean, it shouldn't be possible on harp, you would think. But.
And she'll be joined on Sunday by some other musicians. Who are the musicians joining her?
Yes, to add a little more variety, we brought Siwoo Kim is a violinist that she works with a lot, and then a guitar player from the Brazil guitar duo, João Luiz Rezende, will also be coming with her. So the program will be very varied. We'll have some Bach, we'll have some Brazilian music, and a little bit of everything in between. So very exciting.
And I didn't mention that there is another event tomorrow as well, some demonstrations and a workshop?
She is. In addition to the Sunday concert, on Saturday she's doing at 2:30, there's going to be a harp demonstration, which I think is really more intended for non-harpists. She'll talk about the harp and how it works, because a lot of people really don't understand it very well. And that's from 2:30 to 3, and then at 3 o'clock she's going to do a workshop for harp players, and the public is invited to both of those events, and both are free.
I think that should be very interesting, because having been close to a harp, I mean, if you lay it down, it does sort of look like a piano. You think it would just, you know, sort of transfer directly, but it doesn't. They have all these pedals.
Yeah, it gets a little involved. So.
It gets very involved, yes, but they have to manipulate in order to get all the notes they need.
Yes, absolutely.
It's not nearly the size of like a full piano. Brian, following the Bridget Kibbe concerts this weekend, what's next on the series?
Well, the next thing we have is November 11th, which is another Sunday. At 7 o'clock, we have a concert that's called In Remembrance of Victims of Violence. And it's a choral concert. The First Presbyterian Choir and a chamber choir from Union College will be joining us as well as some instrumentalists. The idea for this came, I don't know, probably a year or so ago. I think after one of the mass shootings I saw, and got an idea of doing something. You know, as musicians, sometimes we feel like, you know, it's hard to be a part of these things that are happening in the world. Sometimes you feel like, well, what can we do as musicians, perhaps? And so I felt like maybe we could put together something around this idea of violence and things that are happening in our society, and the mass shootings that people are seeing, you know, on a regular basis, unfortunately, it seems. And so we're doing music. The first section of it is music from different requiems, the Requiem of John Rutter. There's several pieces from that. A Kyrie from Vierne, Andrew Lloyd Webber, a piece of his. And in between all of those, we have readings. Pippa White, who has joined us before, is wonderful local person, and she'll be doing some readings. We have parts of speeches from people like John F. Kennedy, or Robert F. Kennedy, Leonard Bernstein, and some poems, Dylan Thomas, Owen Shears, who's a British poet, contemporary British poet. It actually turned out to be on Veterans Day, which is the 100th anniversary of World War I. And so there's a tribute to veterans and something about World War I in there as well. So I think a very powerful, moving event, but hopefully something that adds comfort and healing and hope for us all. So after the Requiem section, then we have an instrumental piece, a Kaddish, which is the Jewish prayer for the dead, basically. And then some music of comfort and hope at the end, something with like the 23rd Psalm, different things like that at the end. So it's a very powerful event.
And again, that's November 11th, as you mentioned, yes. Veterans Day. And I'm sure we'll be talking a little bit more about that as well. The first performance on this series, harpist Bridget Kibbe. She gives a harp demonstration tomorrow. That's 2:30 to 3 p.m. And then a concert with violinist Siwoo Kim, as well as guitarist João Luiz Resende Lopez. And that concert is at 3 p.m. on Sunday at First Presbyterian Church in Lincoln. Brian Foltner is with the Arts for the Soul series. Brian, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is Friday Live on NET Radio. The Joslyn Art Museum in Omaha has new exhibitions. Corbin Hirschhorn of KVNO has more.
The Joslyn Art Museum will open three exhibitions this weekend: Pattern and Purpose, American Quilts from the Shelburne Museum, The Race to Promontory, The Transcontinental Railroad and the American West, and a collection of photography by Richard Moss. Pattern and Purpose hails from Vermont's Shelburne Museum, founded by Electra Havemeyer Webb, and it was the first collection of quilts regarded as art in the museum setting. Toby Jurovics, chief curator at Joslyn.
She had this quote. She said, "I'm just starting to kind of sort these out." She said, "Some I think are folk art and some are just quilts." And I think that that's, in a certain way, kind of what many people think when they first hear about, well, an exhibition of quilts, you know, I've got a quilt at home, or my grandmother had a quilt, and it seems like maybe it's perhaps rather anomalous to think of them on the museum wall. And I guess I would say that you'll have that feeling until the moment you walk into the gallery. And they are, you know, really just spectacular in the way they kind of fill the space and delight the eye. And it is kind of like strolling through this almost this wonderful kind of garden of abstraction.
While quilts are more readily known for their practical uses, they've also served a monumental purpose, marking or celebrating moments in time.
I think that we commonly think of quilts as kind of existing in a private space. And when you have people to your home, you know, you have them to your living room or your dining room, or maybe you have a cup of coffee in the kitchen, but most of the time you're not sort of touring them to taking them around to all of the bedrooms in your home. So you think of them as, you know, almost the sort of more private or intimate, you know, part of your house, but they really played a very significant social and civic roles. They had this, were intended to have this very public presence. So some of them were made, for instance, as wedding presents, or could be part of a dowry. There were quilts that were made for display at a county fair.
The Race to Promontory is a collection of American Western photography documenting the completion of the railroad that would change the nation overnight.
You can almost say it sort of radiates out from one photograph, which is that famous image by A.J. Russell of the meeting of the rails. And we have the locomotives from the Central Pacific and Union Pacific at Promontory Summit on May 10th, 1869. And it's arguably the most well-known image from the 19th century. And the exhibition kind of traces the two photographers who followed the construction of the Union Pacific and Central Pacific lines, A.J. Russell working from Omaha out to Utah, and Alfred Hart photographing for the Central Pacific from Sacramento to Promontory Summit.
Pattern and Purpose, The Race to Promontory, and a collection of photography by Richard Moss open to the public tomorrow at Joslyn, Saturday, October 6th. There will be a members' preview of Pattern and Purpose tonight. Each exhibition will feature related events and programs throughout their run, including lectures, discussions, and performances. For more information, visit joslyn.org. For Friday Live, I'm Corbin Hirschhorn.
I'm Genevieve Randall. You're listening to Friday Live, coming to you from the Mill in downtown Lincoln. In the winter of 1888, a ferocious blizzard ripped through Nebraska without any warning, leaving thousands of children struggling to safely find their way home. Snowcatcher is a story about one of those children, and it'll be playing at the Johnny Carson Theater in Lincoln October 17th through the 21st. And joining me to talk about the play are Peter Walquist and Becky Bozen from Blixt, as well as Deb Weber with the Lincoln Arts Council. It's great to see all of you.
Good morning, Jen.
Good morning.
Nice to have you. So other than director Robin McKercher, this is a one-woman play written and performed by you, Becky.
That is correct.
Why did you choose that format?
I don't know.
It's a lot of work for you.
It is a lot of work, and the joints are creaking, and it's pretty physical work. But
The short answer is that we wanted to make this something very self-contained for accessibility. So what I mean by that is we wanted to make sure that we could take this show to multiple kinds of venues or classrooms or different places where we didn't have to think about loading in a heavy set and a tour bus and a huge cast.
And who's your character and why did you choose her?
Well, the protagonist is Hattie. She's 6 years old. She's a homesteader child. And I chose her, first of all, because I had a six-year-old at home at the time. And so it was a voice I could relate to. But also because this show picks up on many relevant themes for young people today. When we started looking at the hardships of being a homesteader, we realized that there were some direct parallels that you could draw between being a kid with some struggles then and being a kid with some struggles now. And we're dealing with a blizzard, so things like heating, poverty, sense of home, your family around you, you know? And so we wanted to make it a small person with a big voice, so the small people in the audience could think about their own big voices and how they want to use them.
And Petra and Deb, this production, it's produced by Blix, but commissioned by two other organizations, and there's always some outreach and connection with any of these shows. You want to talk a little bit about that aspect?
Absolutely, yes. So it's presented by the Lincoln Arts Council in celebration of its 50th anniversary. So we're super excited about that. And of course, the Lincoln Arts Council is also one of our co-commissioners, along with the Midwest Theater in Scotts Bluff. So pretty cool to have commissioners from across
the state.
Yes, really all across. And as you say, we always do offer that engagement part of what we do because it's just as important as providing the performances. So we'll be working with students at Clinton and Campbell, and we're also working with our collaborating organization, Morning Hope Grief Center. So we will be having Snowcatcher as a kind of center of the work and then exploring that in workshops with students and also adults, so spanning the ages.
And Deb, congratulations to Lincoln Arts Council on 50 years.
Thank you.
Amazing. So what are your thoughts on this production? What do you think of Snowcatcher? What should you tell listeners about this?
Well, I've heard Becky read through it, and it is amazing. When I heard it, I thought immediately of my mother. And then I thought about my daughters. And all I can really say is that the arts obviously have such an ability to help people heal, to find their voice, to think about different perspectives. And absolutely, Becky has done an amazing job of making that happen. So we're very honored and happy to be the co-commissioners and the producer.
And you guys have done the show other places.
Yes, we premiered with our friend Billy in Scotts Bluff at the Midwest Theater, the Tassel in Holdridge, and Community Players at Beatrice so far. Actually, on the 130th anniversary of the school children's blizzard with school children in the
during
audience.
A blizzard. During the blizzard, right? What do kids tell you about the show? What do they think?
It's so interesting because this show deals with an underlying theme of childhood bereavement. So Hattie, our six-year-old, her mother has died of smallpox the year before. And one might think that would make this kind of show a downer, but kids are excited by it. Kids identify with a protagonist who has some struggles. And amazingly, and maybe because it's just so weirdly physical, kids come out and say, that was so fun.
Yes.
So we're dealing with some sensitive topics. But the thing about children is they are resilient. And so a kid who's dealing with a struggle doesn't live their life like every moment's a struggle. They plow through and they play and they have people they love and are connected to and they look for reasons to be happy.
Well, you know what this makes me think of too is even though it's based in a true, if there's a true event, this is a historical event that happened, it has that fairy tale element in that. In
yes.
That, you know, a fairy tale might deal with a scary step parent or,
yes.
You know.
Or the snow catcher.
Yes, right. That's yes. Right. And so there is that element of this, even though you're basing this in a true historical event.
Absolutely. I would consider this magical realism. And there is absolutely that fairy tale aspect because it's coming from the mind of a six-year-old child. So we ride her imagination.
All right. Snowcatcher is the name of the show, and it runs at the Johnny Carson Theater in Lincoln, October 17th through the 21st, a production from Blixt. Thank you to Deb Weber from Lincoln Arts Council, to Peter Walquist, and Becky Bozen, who is the one-woman show here in Snowcatcher.
Or something.
No, it's true. One-woman show. Thanks for telling us about the production this
morning. Thank you for having us, Jen. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Coming up this morning on NET Radio, classical music on Morning Concert, and this afternoon, Laura Black and Classics by Request. Be sure to visit the NET website for podcasts of the show at netnebraska.org/radio. Thanks to everyone who makes Friday Live possible, including Robert Goldberg, James DeShano, Josie Sittig, and associate producer Dave Hughes. I'm Genevieve Randall.
Support for programming comes from Sheldon Museum of Art, presenting a conversation with photographers John Davola and Anthony Hernandez. They will discuss their shared interest in depicting remote and abandoned pieces in pursuit of contemporary landscape Monday, October 8th at 6 p.m. For more information, sheldonartmuseum.org. The Lead Center for Performing Arts in Lincoln, presenting Nitty Gritty Dirt Band October 17th. With singles including Fishing in the Dark and Mr. Bojangles, the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band performs their first Lead Center concert. For tickets, leadcenter.org. And Cornerstone Bank, a family-owned bank providing custom investments, trust, and estate planning services since 1882 with 40 central Nebraska locations. CornerstoneConnect.com. Cornerstone Bank, building trust on a solid foundation.